You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life, and today a story about guiding boats on Lake Michigan into safe harbor. Here's producer Steve Gotcher.
In The Lighthouse, a recent thriller by filmmaker Robert Eggers, solitude leads to madness for two lighthouse keepers. But solitude was rarely an issue at the range lights in Bailey's Harbor. WPR's Norman Gilliland brings us the story from eastern Door County.
In 1869, when the range lights were built, Bailey's Harbor was considered the only safe harbor north of Milwaukee. The town was a busy logging center, shipping cordwood and cedar posts, poles and hemlock bark to other Great Lakes ports. Ed Miller shows people through the range lights. He wears the visored cap and double-breasted navy blue coat that were the garb of lighthouse keepers.
The last keeper here was Henry Gaddy. He was here 27 years, as long as his predecessors combined. When Henry arrived in Bailey's Harbor, he was single. He was considered a very eligible bachelor because he had a pay of about $600 a year, and he came with a house, so all the single girls in Bailey's Harbor were interested in Henry.
As for Henry, he did tie the knot and celebrated in a typical Wisconsin way.
There's a picture we have of Henry with about eight other gentlemen. They're all holding a mug of beer. Henry's in his lighthouse keeper's uniform, and the waiter's in a white uniform. They all have full mugs of beer, and the label on the bottle that the waiter's serving is Miller Beer. So it was Miller time in 1901.
Some things never change. Restorations of the lighthouse have turned up some surprises. Under the parlor floor, newspapers from 1944 and 1945 with screaming headlines and big photos of the late Franklin D. Roosevelt and his successor, Harry Truman, and Lauren Bacall.
We're going to head up the stairs that the lighthouse keeper would have went up many times, starting in the evening, throughout the night, and the following morning. First, he would light the lamp right before dusk, and then he would go up several times to adjust and trim the wick. Because if he didn't adjust the wick, he got a smoky flame, which sooted up his lens and reduced the light output of the lens. So lighthouse keepers got the nickname wickies because they were always adjusting the wick. And then in the morning, he would extinguish the light right after the sun came up. And then by 10 o'clock, he had to have everything all polished up and ready to go for the next evening.
Now we get to the heart of the matter. A bright object about the size of a snare drum.
So in the lantern room, we're looking down the range light boardwalk at the front range light. And the original lens that was in the range light was a fifth order Fresnel lens. And it was such that it cast the light out about 6 or 7 miles out over the water. Today we have a modern lens. It's still lit. And it's an active aid to navigation. We're back on the lighthouse list in navigation charts as a useful lighthouse.
To get to the lower part of the range lights, you follow a 950-foot boardwalk toward the lake. Along the way, until the autumn snow falls, you'll see tamarack, wood lilies, yellow lady slippers, blue flag iris, and one or two shoots of asparagus gone wild. In 1930, the lamps were replaced by automated electric lights, and the keepers became a thing of the past. Although solitude was never an issue at the range lights of Bailey's Harbor, they were and are serious business on a lake that has swallowed boats for as long as there have been boats.
WPR's Norman Gilliland talked about the Bailey's Harbor range lights on the eastern coast of Door County. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Find more Wisconsin Life on wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Steve Gotcher.
And now to electric vehicle targets by 2030 and a dramatically expanding EV market in the years ahead. We're looking closely at the transition and the charging infrastructure requirements with a new white paper. Are you an electric vehicle owner? What are the challenges of driving one? Are there enough charging stations in your area? It's 800-642-1234. Mike Nicholas is senior researcher for the International Council on Clean Transportation's Electric Vehicle Program. Its report is called Charging Up America, Assessing the Growing Need for U.S. Charging Infrastructure Through 2030. Mike, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. You know, electric vehicles are still such a small segment of the overall auto market. And we see President Biden and U.S. automakers setting these benchmarks that would dramatically speed up EVs. Is this changeover from gas a realistic scaling up, a realistic timeline?
You know, it really is. I think people don't realize that it's not as big a transition as we think. So it's big in some ways, but there is electricity everywhere and people have infrastructure even in their house. And so I think that this paper that we looked at was public infrastructure, and that's the other side of the story. But I think we're pretty well prepared, better than we might think.
Yeah, you know, we need better charging networks across the country. We need chargers in more places. We need faster chargers. How do you prioritize these challenges? Like, what comes first?
So in our report, we looked at the entire charging infrastructure. And looking at what you prioritize first, I think the Biden's goal or Biden's, the bipartisan infrastructure bill looks at some of these areas that we might want to look at first, which is what is not being invested in quite right now, like rural infrastructure, for example, and apartment infrastructure. So some of these gaps that are not being filled now are things we might need to focus on, where other people can focus on things that are a little bit more near term.
Yeah, and you project electric vehicle sales would reach 36% by 2030. What are the roadblocks that President Biden and the administration faces with this goal?
So I think a lot of it is a lot of education for people, just finding out that electric vehicles are a good choice for them. So they're cheaper, they're faster for some people. That's important. And I think, and for some people, the environment is the number one concern. So electric vehicles provide benefits on all these areas. And I think just going out and trying one is actually the biggest barrier in knowledge for people to think that this is a good choice for them.
Well, break down some numbers for us. How many electric vehicle chargers would be needed under this plan?
So under this plan, so I think Biden's plan only does part of what we need for till 2030. So it's important to know that this won't do everything. There's utilities who can play a big role. And people in general, companies, people, private individuals, they'll put some investment in as well. And this gets us, the bipartisan infrastructure bill gets us a great down payment. It helps pay for a lot of this public-private partnership. And so it's a big problem, but there's many people, there's many actors who will be participating in this transition.
So based on your estimates, can you break down how much of this infrastructure would cost over this timeline?
So that's a good question. So we estimated about $28 billion from now until 2030. And the bipartisan infrastructure bill is looking at around $7.5 billion. So it won't do everything. But even though these numbers seem quite big, they're not really big on a per person basis or per car basis. And they're quite manageable in the scheme of things. And we spend a lot of money on a lot. So when you look at that one big number, when you actually look at it, it's a pretty modest investment and something that will pay off over time.
Well, let's bring in a call now. Jeff is joining us from Belfield. Hi, Jeff. What is your question about EVs?
Yes, good morning. I'm intrigued by the idea, but I do have a number of questions that need to be answered for me. First of all, I'm concerned with some of the reports of vehicles catching on fire parked in garages overnight. And I'm also concerned about the longevity of the battery. Typically today with vehicles, we can drive them maybe 200,000 miles pushing it. Am I going to be able to do that with an electric vehicle without needing to have a large expenditure for a battery, a new battery at some point? And what happens to the old batteries? Are those materials recycled or do they end up in a landfill? So those are some
great
of the questions I'd like to have answered. Thank you.
Jeff, thank you. And certainly range anxiety, one of those questions. Go ahead.
Yeah, so there's a couple aspects. One is safety. And I think that, safety is I think a little bit, it's very much focused on since it's a new technology, but if you look at the frequency of just car fires in general, you have gasoline is very flammable and it can be dangerous in certain situations. And we've just learned to kind of deal with it. And I think the incidence of fire is pretty low. And, for those, every time that there is something that happens, it's a time to learn. But I think that the frequency is not that bad. The second question is about battery life. Like, how long should I expect my battery to last? Well, they're guaranteed for 10 years at a certain capacity, and it's with these long range vehicles, there might be a little bit of drop in capacity, but the battery is not going to fail after 10 years. It's just just like any used car, it doesn't doesn't do everything it did in the beginning, but it does most, I think you can expect 90. I have a car that's 10 years old and I get 90% of what I used to get. And that's just fine for me. So you might have to charge a little bit more often, but with these cars coming out, it's not a big deal. And then finally on the recycling, everything can be recycled. And it's a matter of economic imperative to do so. And right now there's just not a big enough market of used batteries to kind of spur that market. So I think we'll see those problems addressed as we see a lot of these cars coming off the road. And there's a lot of very valuable metals that can be recycled. So I don't really have a issue with that. Yeah.
Yeah. But with EV owners and prospective owners, there's that fear that the car will run out of power before reaching a suitable charging station. How real is that range anxiety?
So the anxiety may be real, the reality is that once you get driving it, that you'll find that a lot of what you previously thought might be a problem isn't a problem. And there's always a technology called plug-in hybrids where you have a backup gasoline engine, where as soon as it's like a short-range battery electric vehicle, and when the battery runs out, then it just switches over to gas. And so you don't have to really worry about that. But a lot of those people, as soon as they get used to that, then they realize that they want an electric vehicle and they don't need that that crutch. It's just about getting used to a new new way of doing things. But yeah, but public charging, as our report details, will be a big part of helping people live their life seamlessly with an electric car.
Mike Nicholas is a researcher with the International Council on Clean Transportation that released a 39-page white paper on charging infrastructure. Will your next vehicle be electric? Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the future of EVs? What is holding back the technology? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Mike Nicholas here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. New steady charging infrastructure is necessary to support the transition to electric vehicles. A new white paper from the environmental nonprofit called the International Council on Clean Transportation says the U.S. will need about 2.4 million public and workplace chargers to be installed in less than a decade to support rapid EV growth. We have senior researcher Mike Nicholas, who's with us for about 10 more minutes. Let's go to Dave now in Toma. Hi, Dave. What would you like to add? Hi, Dave. Can you hear us? Nope, we can't hear Dave. Let's go to Stephen now in Montreal. Stephen, hi.
Oh, now I'm gone.
Oh, Dave, are you there? I think we're having trouble here hearing our callers. Mike, I want to ask you, what about home at-home charging? What have you seen there for homeowners with electric vehicles?
That's a really good question. And I think it provides a lot of the benefits that people like about electric vehicles is just the convenience. Driving in your garage, you've got a plug in front of your car, you plug in your car, and you just don't think about going to the gas station anymore. So home charging is one of those big benefits for electric cars. And it's one of the things that makes it better and more convenient than a gasoline car. But not everyone has access to home infrastructure. And so that's what our report looks at is, okay, for those people who don't have infrastructure at home yet, because we hope that we're always working towards better like home solutions, that we can provide enough public infrastructure, workplaces and fast charging to get them the ability to buy a car and move around. But home charging is really one of those things that make people like electric cars better than what they used to have.
Workplace chargers is also part of this infrastructure scale up. What do you see is the role of companies in these chargers?
You know, that's a really good question. People sometimes ask about the business case for workplace charging, and it's really multifaceted answer. One is that workers are now demanding, or when they go to get a new job, they ask, do you have workplace charging? And so the workplaces are taking notice and like, yeah, maybe we should install a few chargers. They're also looking at their environmental profile. We as a company, what are our values? And so they can put in some chargers because of that. And then there's other people who just say, okay, it's a service, we'll charge for it. And it's just like anything else that a building might have, like parking. Why do you provide parking for your employees? It's just as something that makes the job easier for people to be an employee there. So
I wonder how that will work out. I mean, will companies pay for putting in this infrastructure, or would they look to the federal government for support on that? And I also wonder if employees would ultimately see it come out of their paycheck to use the chargers.
Well, ostensibly, you would have the fees for charging could cover the cost of the chargers. But typically, workplaces need maybe a little bit of a nudge. And so a little bit of a cost share. They're motivated to do it, but they need an incentive, at least in these days. Then they're happy to put in the infrastructure. But the other thing about workplaces is there's sometimes complicated things about parking lots. Who owns the parking lot? Who owns the building? Are they renters? And those sort of things. And those things have to be figured out as well. So it's not just the desire to put them in. We see a lot of desire for companies to put them in. It's some of the details.
Yeah. We're talking with Mike Nicholas, who's a senior researcher for the International Council on Clean Transportation's Electric Vehicle Program, as we look at EV infrastructure across the country. And let's go to Dave in Toma, trying again. Dave, are you there? Can you hear us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Good. Go ahead.
I had two questions. One is, if I do get going a long distance trip, how long is it going to take me to recharge my battery when I stop somewhere? And my other comment is, I think the government should stay out of it and let the maybe give incentives, but let the private sector decide where to put the chargers. Because, the government doesn't decide where to put a gas station. And if there's a profit to be made, they'll cover the country just fine.
Mike, go ahead.
Yeah, those are two great questions. And one, so with the longer range, I mean, I think of it in terms of like, how long do I want to go driving in a car without stopping? And so we're looking at cars around 300 miles, and that's about 4 hours in the seat. And by the time 4 hours comes up, I'm ready to take a 30-minute break. And that's about how long it takes to fast charge. And, you know, fast charging technology certainly can go faster, but the cars we see today, it's about a half hour to fill up, you know, the part of the tank that people usually don't go to empty. They usually don't go to completely full. But yeah, I'd say about a half hour, and can be up to an hour if you, you know, if you want to take a break, have something to eat. And the second question is, yeah, should the government be even looking into this? And I think as we looked at, as we said in the beginning, the total amount of investment is not what the Biden the bipartisan infrastructure bill is looking at. It's looking at filling those gaps. And it's if you look at the text of the bill, it looks at rural areas that might not see demand enough early enough to warrant a charger. And so there's areas that are gaps that will, as you say, eventually be served. But it's kind of like rural electrification. You know, I think it was back in the 20s, they decided, okay, everyone's going to have electricity in the United States. And without that, it would have taken a lot longer. So it's really, it's kind of an investment in just pushing this along, getting the people able to have a car that might not be in either like a low-income community or a rural community. They might not see it for years. So yes, the private investment will come, but it just might be later.
Just a few seconds left here. What are you watching for as part of infrastructure for EVs? What is on your radar?
So I kind of alluded to it earlier. I think home charging infrastructure is something we really need to still look at. I think it makes it the best experience to own an EV. So, you know, continuing to look at apartments, how do we get apartments connected, on-street charging, basically where do cars live at night? I think that's one focus. And then, of course, the public infrastructure, fast charging. How can we get people to believe that they can drive a car anywhere they want to go and there's infrastructure is not a problem?
Well, Mike, thank you for joining us.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Mike Nicholas, senior researcher for the International Council on Clean Transportation. We have a link to their report at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.